This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 141, brought to you in association with Smart Pension. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Matt Cocaine, CCO of Yapily, to discuss how open banking can help SMEs. Unlike consumer open banking, where it has been yet another media fest, hype fest, and general snooze fest for the populace, apparently the very different world of SMEs can really benefit and are benefiting. Yapily's mission is to build an inclusive and collaborative financial world by making banking and payments simpler and cheaper for businesses, as well as retail banking users. They have an ecosystem-focused technology platform offering participants an easy way to retrieve financial data and initiate payments by providing one single secure API for connectivity to all financial institutions, which sounds very nice and rather makes me wonder what one of them is. Also, enticingly, they seek to enable the market to seamlessly pivot where no one has seamlessly pivoted before, from open banking to open finance, which sounds cool and the kind of thing I should know what the difference is, but I don't. Anyway, if you don't either, listen up and you might find out too. So without further ado, let's dive straight in. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Matt. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me on, Mike.
So as always, it gets harder and harder in a busier and busier world to find a topic to talk about to busy folks such as yourselves, especially when busy folks such as yourselves are busy entrepreneuring and also having sort of young kids and all that kind of stuff. You're lucky if you get the time to sort of breathe in and out and sleep. But you said that back in the day, you were doing sport.
Yeah, I used to play quite a bit of rugby, played at WASPs and junior England levels, but injury then got in the way, so I had to become a management consultant on the back of that.
So WASPs and junior England levels sounds quite good to somebody who doesn't know that much about rugby. Mine was a rugby school, but I liked football, so I was the wrong school from that basis. But when you play the junior England level, I mean, how many people get to that level out of the whole country? Is it a squad of 50 or...?
No, it's kind of a squad of 20 or 30 boys. Yeah. I think it's changed quite a lot now because I'm old and crippled compared to being young and fit back in the day.
What age was this then?
18, 19.
Well, you must have been bloody good then. So what position did you play?
I played him as a prop.
Right. And you look like you'd make a very good prop. You look like you could keep the ceiling up, yeah. If I may say so.
I had the benefit of playing with some very good players at the time. So Johnny Wilkinson played, Lewis Moody played in that same age group.
Oh, wow.
So they were far more talented.
I've heard of them.
Far more talented and dedicated players than I was.
Let's look at it on this the other way. They're not involved in open banking, you know?
Lucky them.
So what led you to giving up a future as an England international for the commercial world?
So I was probably a little bit too small, and I didn't want to do sports science at university at the time. It was very much go and do sports science and join one of the professional clubs. So I went off and went to Oxford, did geology, wanted to be a geologist, and then became a management consultant at Accenture for my sins and joys.
And did you play rugby at Oxford?
Yep, played there.
What, college or university? Or?
Both.
Oh, I see. So you got a blue, did you?
Nope. Fractured my knee just before.
That's not a very good idea, actually. That's unlucky. So you didn't get your blue. Did the wrong team win?
Yes.
What, you won?
Yeah, so we won that year. So it was a good year in that regard.
And I fractured my knee, actually, when I was about to go rowing, but nowhere near at such a prestigious level of sport that you were at. So how did you fracture your kneecap? Let's talk about patellae.
I got hit by a very big Samoan, and my knee was stuck in the mud, and he kept carrying on, and my knee kind of just went the other way.
Oh, so you sort of tore your ligaments rather than breaking your patella?
Fractured the patella because it got hit quite hard and then ripped a layer of the ligaments.
That's unlucky. And it's also very painful, actually. I don't know whether you noticed.
Yeah.
I mean, mine was all in the early 80s, and it wasn't that long since the IRA used to kneecap people in Northern Ireland, and I saw someone had been kneecapped twice or something like that. And I actually understood directly why, because it's about the most painful thing you can possibly do, because I was just running along. And as you can imagine, it's gruesome. I hope you've all had your breakfast or your lunch listening to this one. The patella is under huge strain from ligaments and muscles on both sides. And so if you fracture it, not to put too fine a point on it, mine ended up lots of pieces, some of which were halfway up my thigh and some of them sort of down there. So that was pretty gruesome. And well, I got mine all wired up in hospital, and it was actually just a week before the bumps. And my replacement, they were about to get their oars, get four winds in a row, basically, for everyone else. And my replacement fell off his seat, and they didn't. So that was even more painful, as was the fact that I recovered very quickly. And the physiotherapist, and probably with you, always pushing you. But if you're a young, motivated 18-year-old or 20-year-old or 21-year-old who does a little bit of sport, or more sport like you did, you can actually be incredibly motivated, and you can recover extremely fast. And I recovered faster than my knee strength did, in that the beginning of the next term, I was climbing over the gates to get in, because in those days they locked them at 2 o'clock in the morning, which was an imposition for me. These days I'm lucky if I ever see it on an airplane. And I kicked a stair and it broke again 6 months after I'd done it the first time, which was very unlucky, actually. Anyway, the Paul Gascoigne point was exactly the same thing that happened to him, which is that he was very motivated, he pushed his recovery, but because physiotherapists are used to having to push people, if they push people who push themselves, you can actually recover faster than you ought to.
Yes, I didn't have that problem on the knee. I had that problem on my neck, which I fractured.
Oh, I can't compete with you in that one, fortunately. I'm not a doctor. I should say this, actually, in case anybody's taking medical advice on this one. If it's not a good idea to break your patella, it's even less of a good idea to break your neck, isn't it?
I could agree. It didn't hurt as much.
Really?
Oh, no, right. Didn't hurt as much. It's just more of a long-term problem.
Ah, so you were very fortunate then that your sort of head is still connected.
I think I was about 2 centimetres away from being paralysed from the neck down.
Oh, God. Not worth thinking about, is it really? And how long does it take to recover from that then?
Only a few months. You effectively have to let the bone regrow and join back together. But luckily, I still have a lump on the back of my neck 20-something years later from that particular injury.
I think maybe the good Lord was trying to sort of suggest an alternative career, which we'll come to now, probably into open banking at the time. I've heard the thing about karma rather than God, but you can use karma or God depending on your belief system or just life, that life gives us gentle nudges. And if it's really quite keen on us doing something or not doing something, and we don't listen to the gentle nudges, they get sort of slightly bigger until you get hit by a 4x2 around the head.
Yeah, I think 2 serious injuries, 4-21, were pretty much the hint that professional rugby wasn't for me.
Right, okay, so you could have had a career in professional rugby, and SME Open Banking wouldn't have been the same without you. So how did you get from breaking important parts of your body to SME Open Banking?
So I started as a management consultant many years ago at Accenture. Did that for a few years, worked at a boutique consultancy, then got into software technology. I probably did about 10 or 12 years of software for commodities trading. So doing trading platforms, working for lots of big US technology firms, which finished with SunGard, at which point I tried to do something else, and I joined Yodlee to really grow their European business. That didn't work so well, and so I'm now here at Yapily, having done kind of nearly 2 years in open banking, helping us grow our footprint and be able to support more customers as they wish to utilise open banking data.
And myself, having worked in companies of every scale from sort of 1 to 250,000, my experience is they all have their pros and cons. And going back to listeners, the grass is always greener, so no doubt there are people listening to these podcasts in Megaco or Megabank thinking, oh, wouldn't it be nice working somewhere like a Yapily or a Monzo, or that would be quite cool. And there may well be people listening to this who've been working in fintechs for a while who are thinking, you know, this is actually quite tough and uncertain, and it's much harder than I thought it would be, or people have founded them, and thinking, do you know, why don't I just go and get a proper job in Megaco, in a big consultancy, where they pay me the same 2 days in a row. So based on your experiences of, let's call it sort of big co and small co, to make it simple, based on big co and small co world, what did you find was the good things about big co? What kind of stuff did you learn there that would have been hard to learn elsewhere? And equally, what do you see the good things about being small co?
I think working at the big firms, you get very clear visibility on how things should be done, not necessarily the way they are done, but there's always a process and a structure in place, generally, to do pieces. And as I was a kind of running professional services and consulting, I saw that both on the client side and internally. The downside of that is there's not a huge amount of flexibility, and there's a lot of reporting processes and rules and regulations that you have to adhere to, which really limit your ability to do interesting stuff. Generally, I think the flip side is that the small firm, it's much harder work because you don't have all those support functions in place. So for example, here I've had to define at Yapily our Salesforce deployment and build all the requirements myself, versus everywhere else I've worked, I've just had it as a solution with sales ops staff to help on that piece. So it's a lot more work, but there's a lot more flexibility, and you can actually help create a business and really drive at whatever level you're at a fintech, you can help drive the strategy and the direction of that firm, which at a big corporate, even when you're at VP, SVP level, you're just a slightly better paid cog in the machine.
Yes, I can recognise what you say. And the other thing, of course, is if you're working for mega bank or mega consultancy, the chances are extremely high that it'll be here in a year's time. So it has the predictability, but the flip side of that is it can be a little dull and, you know, you're, for the sake of argument, PricewaterhouseCoopers, your number's sort of 3 million and 1 out of 10 million or something like that. And next year, if you're lucky, you'll be at number 200 and blah, 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 blah. Whereas small companies, they come and go and people move and all that.
I mean, I think from a sales perspective, it's when you work at the big firm, you're always going to get on that short list or long list because of the brand and the X million dollars that are spent on that brand and that marketing position. Whereas at the small firm, it's much harder to go through that. And it's much more dependent on actually people referring you and saying that you've done good stuff rather than how many million you spent on your marketing budget.
Yes, I have this hypothesis. I mean, in a sense, we're talking about highly structured environments or arguably overstructured environments. And very low structure and arguably understructured environments, or rather new companies that are like that. I mean, you've got a baby, it's very soft and flexible. By the time you're an old person, you're a bit sort of stiff and rigid. There's probably some sweet spot in the middle where, say, medium-sized firm, where you have enough structure that, you know, everyone isn't having to do everything. I remember the first company I worked for. One evening, I remember the two managing directors doing the washing up in the kitchen because somebody had to and everyone else was doing something else, you know? But somehow, you don't really see as many medium companies around in the world. It's like people either succeed and they become big co eventually, or they fail and they become sort of zero, or medium companies get hoovered up by big co who need to buy in something. What's your perspective on that? I mean, am I making this up? Is there a bit of a sort of chasm in the middle between small co and big co?
I think there is, at least. I think it depends on what industry you're working in, but especially in technology, I think there is a bit of a chasm because you either reach that escape velocity and kind of get to a certain size that you can live on your own and you become transitioned to that medium straight big co, or you get acquired. And there's lots of big firms in financial technology who acquire lots of smaller firms because they have a feature or functionality, or they want to kind of import some of that cool fintech and that speed of working into their business, which, by the way they do it, generally kills it. Because they try and force their process and structure onto it.
Yes, I've seen that many times. I've seen many people over the last 20 years, and I say, "Oh, congratulations!" And I do, "Oh, yes, it's great. You know, I get paid. There's a bit of a lock-in for a while, but actually, I've got the senior role and blah blah blah." And in almost no case I can actually think of, in terms of practical people I can visualise sitting opposite at the moment, in no case have they been there 5 years later, because it's just a very different world. And also, talking about different segments, it reminds me of drug companies. Megacos, I mean, Glasgow, SmithKline, Beecham, blah, 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 blah. It's much easier for them to buy some sort of startup, Oxford biotech, that's developed something fast, quickly, sexy, and just sort of buy it and, you know, chuck away the sort of people and all that kind of stuff, than it is to do it. Excellent. Right, okay, so your unique perspective is very appropriate in this context, because we are talking about open banking, which affects all of the companies. Many of your customers will be larger, medium, and smaller companies. So we've all kind of heard of open banking. We touched on it in the recent podcast on credit assessment. And I try actually avoid reading too much about fintech these days. I just prefer speaking to people. But anybody who's read the sort of fintech press for the last couple of years, or the FT or whatever, have heard non-stop about open banking. And it's, as I say, it's a hype fest, and then it's a bit of a snooze fest. So would you like just to contextualise, in a sort of realpolitik fashion, what open banking has amounted to by now for SMEs and for retail?
Yeah, so if you think, alluding to your comment about sort of what's in the news, it's very much focused on the retail consumer end of open banking and how you can aggregate your accounts and see all your money in one place, that type of use case, which is great. And it's a really valuable use case. But actually, here at Yapley, we see the interesting part on the SME and kind of the small corporate side, and how that as an underserved market can actually really be empowered by open banking. I think, and there's a couple of pieces that it can look at, really. There's the piece of how do you see all your transactions in a richer format than just from your bank statement? And you can reconcile that against your invoices and those type of pieces for SMEs. But equally, how can you make payments and get paid more easily? You think about, at least in the UK, the vast majority of companies in this country and SMEs, I think it's 99 point something percentage, is over 6 million of them. And they are historically underserved by financial services. They don't fit into that kind of cool, sexy startup piece, or in the large corporate piece where they can access funding and financial services easily. And that small piece, And with traditional banks kind of pulling back from that sector and closing branches and all the things that have happened in for high street banking, there's really that underserved market. I think open banking allows firms and kind of owners of those firms to actually take control of their finances, decide who they want to share that data with so they can get better financial products. I don't imagine most SMEs get excited about financial products. They really want it to be as simple and easy as possible to allow them to do their job.
Yes, it's interesting because you came recommended to me by a mutual chum, a former guest, whose views I respect. And he was saying, oh, well, you know, you've got to have Matt on and Yapily because they're really good. And I, you know, sort of, well, it's a one-liner. I replied, oh, God, it's not open banking, is it, please? But, you know, his point, and to your point, was it's open banking. And in particular, I think the SME will be very interesting folks on the podcast because it's not the bit that's focused on. So how do the dynamics of the two markets differ? I would assume, for the sake of argument, that you don't kind of have the potential resistance slash reluctance that you do from consumers to reveal all their information. You know, there's a certain extent to which if I show you my personal bank account, I'm kind of showing you pictures of me in the bath kind of thing. You know, there ain't nothing you don't know if you read everything I spent the last year. I'm sure you'd be sort of morally shocked by where my money goes and probably so much on beer. Vice versa. As far as business is concerned, that's literally not so private. It's not personal. It's just kind of, yeah, I've got to pay for batteries for my thing. I bought a new computer, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it depends on how literate the SMEs are about the offers that are there for them. For many years, you've been able to, in the sort of the accountancy software solutions, you've been able to access similar type of data, at least on the data side rather than the payment side, via screen scraping. Now that's been outlawed under open banking, those propositions are becoming smoother and the end user journey is much smoother, especially if you're doing it via a mobile app. If you're on a desktop, it's still a little bit clunky, depending on the bank, but it's much smoother if you're going on your mobile through the application. So I think it's how can they actually then share that data and actually get some value from it? And I don't mean kind of trying to monetize that data. I mean more around how can they then access better loan rates, better bank services, better financing, whatever it is that they're looking for. Or equally, how can they be able to reconcile their invoices against their outgoings in their pieces in one simple place? That's a really valuable activity for an SME and has been quite a manual process.
So let's imagine there's a dozen people at London FinTech Podcast Towers. At the moment, I use a spreadsheet, keep track of my expenditures, keep track of my revenues, and a bank statement comes in and it's got the numbers in. If I was 10 times bigger, I'd have to use some accountancy package and spend a sort of month working out how to use the darn thing. At least I can work out Excel for myself. At the moment, every year, I send my stuff off to my accountant and he sort of edits it up and puts it in the sort of government required format. And I then have to ask him questions like, what does it mean? Sorry, how much am I paying myself? I can't tell it from your accounts because they're so complicated. If I was 10 times bigger, I'd have accountancy packages or whatever. For the sake of argument, I've forgotten who it was, but there might be a market invoice button in there.
Yep.
Oh, I need some cash to pay people this month. Oh, I'll hit the market invoice button. Maybe they can discount some invoices or something like that. But in a scenario where I'm a dozen people and I'm using, which is what I assume a firm of a dozen people does, I'm using some accountancy package from somebody.
Yep.
What practical problems have I got and how can open banking and the likes of a Yapily and your customers, how can they actually help me?
So I think the practical problem is, can you understand your cash flow? So can you understand where you're spending money? The data that you get from your bank statement will just be very basic generally. So if you use a solution like ours, and we power some of the big accountancy platforms, you can have a categorization of your spending, which may or may not be valuable on the piece. It's a different categorization engine to kind of the retail spend of, oh, I'm spending it on holidays.
So it's not like the Monzo thing where it says, you know, entertainment and sex, drugs, rock and roll, holidays, savings.
No, it's a flavour of that, but it's more kind of a business focus flavour of that. So that's your first piece. It's then reconciling those invoice pieces, and you can use the payment side of that. So you can, rather than having someone make a payment to you by a BACS transfer or something with a reference number that may or may not be correct, you can actually send them a payment request through open banking. And as soon as they make that payment as a bank-to-bank payment, it will reconcile against and you'll be able to track that very easily. So you remove the manual work of that. Equally, it's then, what do you want to share your data with? So if you're looking to get a loan or you're looking to get a new financial service from a bank, you can use this kind of data and you can share that via a marketplace solution. You can share it via with your own bank, and they'll actually be able to help you there. Also, it covers multi-bank capabilities. So your typical SME will have a business account, a savings account, and a credit card or a set of credit cards. Be able to capture all of those in one place is quite valuable.
I see. So I think what would probably help me understand the domain better is what all these bits of software are schematically. So if we had a sort of whiteboard, and at the top of it or the bottom of it, we drew a picture of Mike's spreadsheet or Mike's accountancy package if we were 10 times larger. Open banking we're using as a phrase, but in software terms, I presume it's and you can explain what Yapily actually sells, it's a bunch of pipes in a way.
Yeah.
Or wires to connect my spreadsheet to, for example, my HSBC deposit account or something like that. So schematically, how do the various bits of software from my spreadsheet or my accountancy package, your wires or pipes and HSBC account and Citigroup credit card, I mean, how does all this sort of fit together on a whiteboard?
So in kind of your spaghetti world of all those different institutions will come into the Yapily platform, we'll standardise that data, we'll make it in the same format, we'll run categorisation if that's what you wish against it. And then we have a single connection, so a single API, that our customers can consume. And they plug that into their software packages. So that's just one connection. And then effectively they choose the banks they wish to add onto that piece. So we really simplify that point versus your accountancy platform or even your Excel spreadsheet trying to connect to all those different endpoints. We simplify that for them.
I see, that's interesting. In terms of having a simple API to connect, you remind me of Nigel Verdon at Rails Bank, you know, who has this sort of simple, whatever it is, five-line API or something, which will enable to connect to whole bunches of banks around the world for correspondent banking and that kind of stuff. And I was about to say, let's assume that we can, going back to my spreadsheet, and for all I know, you can in modern Excel. I've given up following it for about 10 years. But let's assume I can, in Excel, put equals API brackets, Yapily brackets, I don't know, whatever your 15 parameters are, I think, brackets, and then press enter, and then, you know, it updates me, sake of argument, my net cash balance or something like that. So let's say I can do that. Then how does it practically work at that level then? Yep. So I've typed in equals API Yapily blah blah blah. Excel says Yapily unknown or API unknown. Just how does that thing work?
So the step that's missing there, I guess, is the regulated entity. So the FCA have a regulated entry regime where only those trusted parties can access this data on behalf of their end users.
So I have to be trusted by the FCA then to access?
Yeah, so you have to be regulated and approved by the FCA or whoever you're using the software of. So if you're using one of the software packages.
Oh, I see. They would be.
They are regulated.
I couldn't imagine if 6 million SMEs could go to the FCA and be regulated or want to be regulated.
They probably don't want to be. They could if they wanted to go down that road.
So in practice, they use a software package. I've forgotten what they all are, but anyway. Yeah. Give me a software package.
Intuit.
Right, okay. So I've got that. They're regulated by the FCA, so the FCA check that they're not sort of sending the data to, I don't know, black market people in Russia or somewhere like that, or da-da-da-da-da. So it's a trusted piece of software.
And so that firm will ask you for your consent that they want to get the data, and under open banking you can get all the historical data that's available on a bank's website. So it's a minimum of 12 months. Some banks it's up to 7 years. And you can pull all that data on your first pull, and then you can continue to refresh that request as long as your consent is valid with that institution. They will then come to us, we'll connect them to the open banking directory, we'll run that consent, we'll get the token from the bank, and you have to give the consent to the specific bank so no one else is holding that data, your kind of sign-in piece. We hold that token and we then refresh that data for you on your behalf. Currently you have to refresh that consent every 90 days, but as an industry we're very much pushing that moves from you as the end user having to refresh your consent to actually, if you're still using the service, then your consent is automatically refreshed.
I see. So in terms of the software package that I'm now using, I've upgraded myself from Excel because I don't want to be regulated by the FCA. I've got my software package, and in there it says, do you want to get some your information from HSBC? Click yes. What's the sort code? What's the account code? Is it?
It doesn't ask that.
Gosh. So how does that work then?
So it depends how you're doing it. So if you're doing it on a mobile application and that bank app is on your phone, it will kick you at that point when you have to give consent and it will open up the bank app. You log into your bank app. So if you have biometrics, you'll just log into the bank app. Then it will present a consent screen and say, do you want to share your data?
So it's a bit like Bluetooth pairing in a sense,
yeah,
isn't it?
So do you want to share your data with accountancy package X? Yes, I'd like to. Are you aware this is what you're sharing? Yes. that then completes that journey, brings you back into the accounts package, and then you start seeing all your transactions.
I think the thing that I'd failed to spot is probably the sort of the second line on your main website rather than the first line, which is that you are not just, and this is open banking in general, or you tell us, you're not just a bunch of wires. You're not just a bunch of pipes where water comes in. You're actually enriching the data, or you're adding value to the data or formatting it all.
Yeah, absolutely. So each of the banks have implemented their connections in a different way. Even though in the UK the main banks have to go to the open banking standard, they've all done it in a slightly different way. Some have put more fields in, some have put less fields in. And then in Europe, it's a different beast where standards are not being enforced quite so firmly. So everyone has done their own implementation. The result of that is that data needs to be normalised, standardised and presented in the same structure so that you as the end user don't see the discrepancy between a Barclays or an N26 or a UniCredit or whichever bank selection you're using. So we kind of present that data, and then it's the categorisation that can be run on that to kind of enrich that data so that you can actually get more value out of it.
I see. So anyway, very useful to know how that works for me. I'm sure all your audience know it already, or those of you that didn't know it, you've got some idea of the schematic in your mind. So I can then see that in terms of the accountancy package I'm using, as it can suck all this data in a computery fashion rather than in my Excel, where a monthly statement comes on paper because I'm sort of old-fashioned from HSBC and I type the various sort of transactions in because I don't have a million invoices going out per month.
You could actually just download those transactions in an Excel format if you wanted to.
I don't actually know, because this is so old-fashioned. I don't have online banking, actually.
Really?
Well, they said, did I want it at some point? And I said, oh, OK, then. And they sent me about 54-page forms. So I thought, oh, fuck it. It doesn't take me 5 minutes to enter in the two items. I sent maximum, a couple of dozen invoices per annum, and there's a few transactions. So, yes, anyway, very simple business. Okay, so that's, I was about to say a digression, but actually I think it's sort of very interesting having a schematic of how the process works. Otherwise, one's just left talking about abstractions like open banking without actually really knowing how you're sort of sticking the Lego together. The other aspect that you mentioned, and I mentioned up front, was payments, in that this changes payments somewhat for SMEs and also perhaps individuals, but let's just look at the SMEs.
Absolutely. So I think the key part there is the difference for open banking is the split between the two portions of your transaction data that we've talked about for your kind of accountancy solutions, but also then the payment initiation side.
And sorry, just for the avoidance of doubt, for people whose English might be second language, payments initiation means what in particular?
So that means you as the user initiating a payment via a bank-to-bank transfer method. So you say, okay,
so it's a push payment.
Yeah, it's a push payment. But equally, you can request a payment through.
So it could be like a direct debit payment and pulling it.
Yeah, so there's one-off payments and there's also recurring payments that are the same. Both of those can go through open banking as a initiation piece. And that will then, in the UK, run onto the payment rails that exist between bank-to-bank payments. That enables potentially that it will be much, much cheaper. So rather than having to, the simple use cases, rather than having people pay you by card and then you have to pay Visa or MasterCard, the percentage, you can just remove that and you can have a flat fee that's in kind of pence for that in each payment. And then the bigger the volume, the lower that cost can potentially become. And that's for SMEs for making payments to people, but equally for if they want to request payments themselves. So you talked about the accountancy piece and kind of having a button. You could potentially put a button and say, pay me by bank transfer. And then their customers will actually pay them by that. It's instant, so there's no delay. So you don't have the direct debit, kind of 2 to 3 day delay. It's an instant payment that goes within microseconds. You can confirm payment, that the payment's actually initiated. So you can make an API call that confirms that. And then it hits your bank account quickly and you can link it against that particular customer. So there's two sides to it, both the kind of initiating the payment but also requesting payment.
On the one hand, it's greater visibility, greater control, but also it's greater efficiency. And a couple of episodes ago, we were looking at global supply chain financing, and the numbers that Prime Revenue, the largest non-bank supply chain finance house in the world, we're talking about in terms of the deals they did, was in the billions for megacos, buying soya bean or something like that. if you improve your cash flow management, billions can turn up, which then don't need financing. Now, it doesn't have to be billions. Even for SMEs, for all businesses, cash is really important. For Yabbly, for me, most businesses go bust on making a profit. And it's the cash flow that kills them. So you've got cheaper payments, but also you've got prompter cash flows.
Yeah, I think it's cheaper and quicker. And you can easily see whether someone's made the payment. The days of kind of, oh, I've sent you a check. This removes that whole delay that exists. And cash flow management is critical for growing business. Even in our position, it's important that we watch what we spend, but equally that cash flows is managed effectively.
Yes, and all the people who work in fintech will, at some senior level, will understand this. People who work in Megabank probably won't. I mean, Megabank or Megaco will pay you every month, and that's that. But I certainly know of small companies where people haven't got paid at the end of the month, and it's, hey, look, we're waiting for this invoice to come in or something like that. You know, we are making a great profit, but if you're some young 20-something and your money doesn't get paid that month, the landlord doesn't care. He wants his rent, and that's a good example of cash flow. You know, so I see. Going back to breaking down my scepticisms and cynicisms around open banking, I can certainly see the case that for SMEs, for large organisations or small organisations, organisations of all scales, greater visibility, better aggregation, costs savings and cash flow improvement, well, it's kind of, that's free sex, drugs and rock and roll, isn't it, with a party afterwards? What's not to like, really?
Absolutely. I think the difference between that and the consumer side is consumers don't pay for payments.
Yes.
So it's irrelevant to them.
Yes.
So potentially the more awkward journey of this versus paying by card may block adoption. On the SME side, they generally are paying for payments. They're generally paying for most of the services.
They're paying for bank accounts and all that kind of
stuff.
Yeah,
they're paying for services. So if you can make that simpler and cheaper and quicker, then uptake will be higher.
Yes, and I absolutely see that asymmetry because, again, I've heard the story for quite some time in fintech and out of fintech that, oh, bank accounts aren't free in the UK, you know, and therefore pay us 100 quid per annum, whatever. No, I've had a bank account for whatever it is, bloody 40 years, and I haven't paid a penny, and I don't leave millions of dollars lying around and I don't go overdrawn. So that's never cost me a cent. Equally, my credit cards never cost me a cent. So why should I start paying? But on my business account does cost me. They charge per month. So I'm more conscious of it. And they also charge the payment. So it's a bit of a slam dunk. So we'll come on to Yabbly in a second. But clearly your job is trivial and straightforward as the advantages you present are compelling. And no doubt you'll be hoovering up the market by Christmas on that basis. And if you're not, maybe it's all the salespeople's fault. But before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there. If you're SMEs or if you're wrapped in an SME, then maybe you need to pay more attention to this kind of stuff than you might have appreciated beforehand, because certainly all the media stuff has been rather consumer-focused, mainly because young media writers and the media can't really afford middle-aged or older media writers are more understanding that market than the commercial background of someone like yourself, Matt. And I'd also like to thank my brand partner for the podcast, Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. So we've touched on Yabbly a little bit. Just in terms of anything you want to tell them, listeners a little bit more about Yabbly, maybe you tell us a little bit, or the listeners, what you want them to hear about Yabbly, and then have a little shout out for what kind of people you want calling you in the droves the day after they hear this, or the day they hear this.
Excellent. Thank you, Mike. So I think really in summary, Yabbly, we see ourselves as empowering firms to be able to connect to open banking and open finance, just to pick up on your piece from earlier.
The difference is?
The difference is open banking is kind of, at the moment, very much related to payment accounts. Open finance is around generally putting financial data into APIs, whether they're free, like these ones, or whether they're premium APIs that you have to pay to connect. But it's really about putting as many financial products into an open API structure as possible, so that people and companies can have full visibility of their financial health.
It's a superset of open banking.
Yeah. So I'd say it includes things like pensions, investments, savings, mortgages, loans. Those type of things are what we call open finance. And that's the direction of travel for the industry.
I see. And it's the kind of thing that if I was a professional, I would have known about a long time ago. Better late than never.
So Yabbly really simplify that.
Why are you called Yabbly? Talking about being unprofessional. Is it like rhyme with happily or something?
I think it's from our founder and it has API in the middle of it.
Oh, I see.
to play on us being an API firm.
Your founder was called Mr. Yuli, and he put API in the middle of his name to make Yapily. Right, okay, that's a good story.
So we really simplify the complexity of connecting to multiple banks, multiple standards, and then maintaining those over time.
And what kind of organisations are your clients?
We support people from fintechs, we support corporates, and we support banks. We equally have capability to monitor the APIs of all the banks. So within our dashboard, you can see the availability of each API. We do that. Our differentiation against other aggregation firms, well, we're built for open banking and open finance from the ground up. So we're a two-year-old firm. We don't have any legacy history around screen scraping or reverse engineering. And also we don't sell the data. So we don't sell our customers' data. We don't need to monetize our firm in that way.
And I've heard that this sort of happens rather more than one might think, which I'm surprised to hear.
I think if you look at Facebook and what they do, it exists across different verticals in our world.
Data is money these days, isn't it?
It is. It's the new oil, allegedly. So we don't go down that way for our business model. And I guess we're looking to hire. We're growing fast. We're looking to hire across the spectrum. So we're looking for developers, product people, support people, salespeople. We're really looking to grow.
And you're in London?
Yep. So we're 100% in London. We have cool offices at Mindspace. So shout out to them. Just behind Liverpool Street.
In the heart of the city. Right, okay, well, that's been very interesting. Time's gone by very quickly, and you've clearly done a very good job at explaining it, because it's one of these podcasts where I come away more interested and more enthused about the topic than when I entered it. So this is something sort of very genuine, and I say that with a certain degree of, not cynicism, but a certain degree of ennui after years and years of doing podcasts, and in particular the millions of emails that come to me sort of promising free sex, free drugs and rock and roll, and end up delivering not a lot of them. But you mentioned pensions. I mean, Smart Pension are a prime example. There are some very important, strong developments going on, surrounded by a hell of a lot of fluff and hype and all that kind of stuff, but actually there really is some core to fintech, and I think fintech is working its way towards doing stuff which is just frankly just part of the new digital financial services industry in the 21st century. I mean, you know, you can almost start forgetting the word fintech, apart from the fact it's used in podcasts and things like that. There are developments going on, and going back to mega cos and small cos and the drug business, generally it's the small cos that can run around a little bit faster and make things happen. So I wish you and Yapily every success in the future, and I hope to hear in a few years that you've sold yourselves out for trillions of dollars, and you can then tell me that it's going to be fantastic and you're going to be there for the next 50 years, and I'll say, well, let's see. And then we can meet up and have a beer in a few years' time. So I wish you every success, and good luck with that, Matt.
Great. Thanks for having me on, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory/non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. The mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky, kiss the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye, wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me, 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 watch the firelight.